Blog Talk Radio.
Because we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one. Yes, we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Balbred Radio. My name is Matt Weston. Tonight, I'll be joined by the biggest, fattest, strongest one of them all. I just need to wait a second for him to call in. So if you're listening live, just hold in for a second. We'll get the show going in just a few seconds. Yo.
Hey, it's working now?
Yeah, you hear me okay?
Yeah, sorry everybody.
All right, no problem. All right, let's hit the song in 3 seconds.
Because we're the Houston Oilers, Houston Oilers, Houston Oilers number one. Yes, we're the Houston Oilers, Houston Oilers, Houston Oilers.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Balbred Radio. My name is Matt Weston, and tonight I'm joined with the biggest, fattest, strongest one of them all, BFT. Hey, how's it going? Are you still alive, even though the apocalypse is here in Central Texas with all this ice and sleet and frozen roads?
It's funny, yeah, and see, everything's great here. It's funny because I actually went out and ran an errand, and I was, like, really thankful that the roads were so, quote-unquote, iced up because there's, like, nobody on the road. I got to where I wanted to quickly. The place was open, and everything was great.
Yeah, it's like a zombie.
Stay home, everybody.
Right now. Yeah, it's awesome.
Oh, I know.
I remember that one time I was living in San Marcos and driving up to Austin for work every day, and they had, like, a half inch of snow, and I didn't know if I was supposed to go to work or not, so I went anyways, and I loved it because rather than having it take an hour and a half to get to work, it took me like an hour just driving, 50 miles per hour in an empty road with nobody there and just a little bit of snow, and it was just like the world ended and nobody told me at all, and it was spectacular, though. And so you kind of have to love whenever this sort of thing happens, and I didn't have to go to work today. I don't have to go to work until 11 o'clock tomorrow. So, yeah, the more ice, the better. Give us some more,
Right. Seriously.
Did you know that the divisional round is the best weekend in sports?
It is the best weekend in sports, Big Matt. I can't agree more. And this weekend was even better than normal. I mean, this weekend was – I just can't remember enjoying the game so freaking much.
Yeah, there wasn't a bad one at all this weekend. All four were a lot of fun. I had to come back home from – I thought I was getting sick, and I ended up not even getting sick. I was really upset, but coming back and watching, Minnesota, New Orleans, and Pittsburgh, Jacksonville kind of made it all, I guess, somewhat worthwhile. But I'd rather be out there, but it was still a lot of fun. Come back home and watching these games.
Yeah, and if you picked a weekend to get sick and be forced to watch football, I think this was the weekend.
Yeah, or like the weekend where you thought you were sick and you're 7 miles on the trail and turn around and went off the trail and then felt okay and then was mad and then drove 7 hours back home. That was a good weekend for it to happen. But before we talk about all those games, let's first talk about the Houston Texans, because this is a SB Nation Houston Texans side, and you are probably a Houston Texans fan if you're listening to this. And they did something very important last week. The Texans extended head coach Bill O'Brien for 4 more years, so he's on a 5-year deal now. And they signed new general manager Brian Gainby, the general manager for the next 5 years. So are you excited for 5 more years of Bill O'Brien?
Well, the good news is it's not like this goes against the cap or anything. It's just, Uncle Bob's money, and Uncle Bob's richer than Satan. So the good news is if we have to fire somebody, then it's just out of his pocket, and it's not going to really affect the team. So I kind of, in some ways, don't care. In some ways, it's also good that you've extended them this long. to show some vote of confidence. And I don't know what exactly you're showing a vote of confidence in for either of these guys. But, you know, whatever. You can give Gain all the credit you want to for the 2017 draft. There are so many other poor personnel decisions between, you know, during his tenure. And once again, was that Rick Smith? Was that Brian Gain? To me, this whole thing stinks of, you know, the revenge of Rick Smith, the Rick Smithing of Brian Gain. So we don't know how he's going to do. We really don't know what he's going to be as a general manager. Maybe he's the one who made all the ingenious moves, or maybe he's the one that said, hey, you know, Jeff Allen's much better than Brandon Brooks. Let's go get him. So there's a lot of information we don't have. And, you know, give the guy the usual, give the guy 3 years and take stock of it at that point in time to see whether or not we think he's doing a good job or a bad job. I think if you're going to make a move like this and you want to team him up, you know, Bill O'Brien up with somebody who he's supposedly friendly with and works well with, I don't have a problem with it because you need at least 3 years out of these guys anyway to make that assessment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I the weird thing that I kind of took out of it was the O'Brien extension and why you want to have your general manager and head coach on the same page. You want to have a general manager with the head coach, you know, like and have a good relationship with. You know, both Rick Smith can say it, Brian can say it, but I mean, both guys leak stuff to save face as much as they can. And you don't have that many stories come out from that many different journalists and that many different reports for there to be some sort of strife between the two. And whoever was right, whoever was wrong, whoever was smart, whoever was dumb, it doesn't really matter. You know, they did have a very good working relationship. And so a new general manager comes in, they're both friends and they're both on the same page for 5 years. I mean, I think it's the best way to do it if you're going to be kind of starting afresh and new and take this franchise in a different direction, one led with, you know, Deshaun Watson quarterback instead of a, you know, extraterrestrial defense and thus to run the ball and, you know, kind of hold on for 13-point wins. But the thing that I don't really understand about it all is that Bill O'Brien just, like, vote of confidence that it's his team, it's his franchise, give him his guy, put everything in his pocket for him to lead this team because – you know, we've talked about this a lot. He doesn't really do anything well. My argument's always been that he's gotten the bare minimum out of this team. That's why they've won 9 games. But the team was severely handicapped by him, by his scheme, by his inability to adjust it to the players he has on offense, by the decisions that he personally made at quarterback in wanting guys like Ryan Mallett and Ryan Fitzpatrick and Brian Hoyer and Brock Osweiler, his late game management, him getting, you know, players hurt by playing them when they shouldn't just to make the score look better than it actually was. I'd say they don't lose 35-7 the Falcons, but then Cecil Shorts, you know, almost dies in the end zone. And then Arian Foster does Achilles and ruins his career against Miami. And there's all these different things that he's done. And like, it's just not really there. And then you also have what he did with, you know, Deshaun Watson for the 6 weeks. That was really great. But, you know, scheme-wise, that's one thing he's done well. So I'm not entirely here for O'Brien for 5 more years. I understand he gets fired. It's just Bob McNair's money. But I just don't like the idea of somebody who didn't do that good of a job, just without this much responsibility, and have everything just thrown into, you know, his side of the court. I'm not excited for it. It's going to happen no matter what. But I just don't really understand giving him that much responsibility and putting the entire, you know, making the entire franchise on him.
Yeah, and I've asked this question, and it always seems to be, you know, the basics. And you know, it's the players like them. Well, you know, we saw Bruno Giacomini bragging on Tom Cabell. I can't remember how to pronounce his name now.
Yeah,
it's like over the weekend. Cable, okay. And it's like, you know, Cable is like one of the worst coaches in this era. And you've still got a player talking about what a great coach he is. Look, these guys say this about all their coaches, even Todd Haley, who supposedly has this horrible relationship with Ben Roethlisberger. Ben said, no, let's keep Haley. With a lot of these situations, it's about comfort level. It's like, oh, the guy's been around. I know what he's, you know, I kind of have expectations of what's going to happen. And I think it just goes back to the inherent problem with football is that it's just very risk averse. And here we're seeing just two more cases that, you know, well, the guy's been an NFL head coach for 20 years. I've got to keep him around, but he's terrible. Yeah, but he's proven. Yeah, but he's proven to be terrible. So it kind of goes back to that. I mean, let's look at it this way. Jeff Fisher held a job for that many years. So there is a certain level of fear of change that happens. And so I you know, if you have to go back to and make the argument that the players like Bill O'Brien, and that's the entire basis of your argument, and you can't talk about his game management or what he's done with the quarterback position or his scheme, that he was the offensive play caller again, and that, you know, unless he has Deshaun Watson at quarterback, his offense is trash. And then you can say, well, yeah, but Deshaun Watson was also pretty lights out for this game. Yeah, but that was Deshaun Watson. What changed in that situation? The head coach or the quarterback? So I'm not excited about it either. I don't know what Bill O'Brien has done to prove to earn that. Because the only thing you can kind of point to is that the players like him and those kinds of warm and fuzzy things. But, man, how often do you see a player come out against a coach, Matt?
Mm-hmm. My favorite example of that is just a player where DeAndre Hopkins talked about the summer, how much he loves Tom Savage, how that's his guy, how he can't wait to, you know, catch the balls from him. And Tom Savage is an absolute disaster, you know. And most of these players don't, you know, obviously they're not going to say anything bad about their teammates or their coaches. They shouldn't. They're going to, you know, play for those guys or whatever. I think the other thing about Bill O'Brien, too, is that he went 9-7 3 years, went 4-12 this past season. But people put way too much in the record, and we've talked about it, you know, before I wrote about it, that in a 16-game season, you know, luck and other things play a lot of factors into your record, and that your performance usually doesn't match. And Houston had, you know, a big season like that in 2016 and that ways this year, too. So I think that's their thing as well. And it's weird because it's kind of like that same thing happened with Gary Kubiak, where Kubiak's teams were, you know, close to making the playoffs but never broke through. Where they're, you know, 7-9, 8-8, and they can never get those 10 wins, 11 wins. And that happened after, you know, they were, you know, he was rewarded more time. But the difference even in that situation is that with Kubiak, the team lost games and make the playoffs because they didn't have a defense, and they hired Wade Phillips, and that changed and drafted J.J. Watt. And they also invested in Daniel Manning, Jonathan Joseph. And the other was that it wasn't Kubiak's fault that, you know, Neil Rackers was missing field goals, that Chris Brown was fumbling the ball into the end zone, those sorts of things. In this case with the Texans, it's obvious that, you know, Bill O'Brien's made decisions that impacted the Texans' record and they kept them at the 9-7, you know, sort of wasteland that they're never able to get past because of decisions he made directly. And so I think there's two different situations. So I think one situation, you reward a coach with, you know, stability and, you know, confidence because things were, like, close to bubbling. And then with O'Brien, it's kind of like the exact opposite where you're rewarding him and doing this just because, you know, his record maybe, and I don't know, Deshaun Watson likes him. So, I don't know, the whole thing's weird. I'm not super enthused about it. I understand why, and it was pretty much expected they're going to do this, but I'm not, it's not going to be very much fun. I'm not super excited for, you know, 5 years of Bill O'Brien and Brian Gain. And I know that they can get rid of me their time, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, and you look at, like, today, what happened today, that Matt LaFleur, the offensive coordinator for McVay for the Rams, is interviewing with the Titans job. Could you imagine an offensive mind like Matt LaFleur running Deshaun Watson instead of running an offense for Marcus Mariota? I mean, just how exciting would that be? You know, going back to Kubiak, too, Kubiak ran that 2006 draft. He went out and got mainstays on the offensive line. Kubiak did a lot in that 2006 season. He took a talentless roster from 2005, and he upgraded it tremendously in the offseason. I mean, much less his draft, which is the best Texas draft of all time, and it's not close. Guys like Mario Williams, Eric Winston, Owen Daniels. But he got UDFAs like Mike Brazel. He traded for Chris Myers. He created an entire offensive line in one offseason, and the only problem was his defensive coordinator, and whose name I cannot believe I'm whiffing on, and then he went out and hired Frank Bush. So you're right. It was the defense, but offensively, you could see that Kubiak implemented his scheme, and his scheme was very successful with the crummy offense. And so when you look at Bill O'Brien's scheme, and what's happened to the offensive talent, especially on the offensive line, to me, one was proved to be a very good offensive head coach, and one has proven not to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, except for that, you know, little six-game run with Watson, this offense has been completely terrible. And, you know, that was a great job by him to have a rookie quarterback and put him in a situation that suited him specifically. and, you know, good. But he should have done that all summer. You know, Savage should never done the starter, and that's what you're supposed to do as a head coach. So, I don't know. I'm not super, you know, enthused. I don't think you are either at all. But, you know, we'll see what happens. And if O'Brien can add to what he, you know, started with Watson this year with that offense, I think it's going to be a lot of fun, you know, hopefully again. But I'm still kind of worried about the Deshaun Watson touchdown rate thing as well, too. Do you think that there's any chance at all that we're going to see Rick Smith as a general manager again, or did, you know, the length of these contracts kind of squash all that?
I'm really hoping that's going to be the case, is that if you're managing the team and you, there was still so much before these contracts were signed, there was so much gray area about what Rick Smith's role was going to be coming back. I mean, could you just not imagine, you know, Brian Gain going into work one day and Rick Smith's got his seat up and his, like, scratched out, you know, GM on his nameplate on his desk. So it's, you can kind of see that scenario playing out, right? And this says, to me, definitively says, no, Brian Gain's our dude. Rick, you can come back and, hey, you know, we're going to need sandwiches, dude.
Yeah, and that was the best thing about the length, is that kind of ends that, because if it's like a 2-year deal, and O'Brien isn't getting extended, and then, you know, there's always possibility of Smith coming back there. And also, it would have been such a weird, you know, setting too as well if things worked out this year and then you next year and your game's on a short deal and like that. So at least, like, the roles are assigned. We know he won't come back as a general manager. And it was still just such a weird situation after, you know, the 3 weeks. And I think that also is kind of one of the reasons why Gain was hired too, that all these external candidates they were looking at either were never really even wanting to be there at all. That Gain was the guy, or that, you know, teams didn't really want to, or guys didn't want to interview for the job because of, you know, Smith's ghost kind of wafting around there. So at least it kind of that. So what do you think? Do you think these decisions are going to work out for the Texans in the long term?
I don't know. If you want to take the optimistic view, is that Bill O'Brien changed his offense to suit Deshaun Watson better. So that was the first time we actually saw him adjust his scheme to the player's strengths. I mean, period. I mean, I'm talking like Lamar Miller as Christian Okoye. I'm talking about, you know, trying to run a power scheme game that just didn't fit the team and the athletes that we've got on the team, which is still trash, by the way. So for the first time, he actually adapted his offense for the skill set of the player. So if you want to take the optimistic view, there it is. If you want to take the pessimistic view, Bill O'Brien hasn't really done crap as an offensive coordinator if Deshaun Watson wasn't running the team. And let me add, what is to say that Bill O'Brien still tries to put a square peg into a round hole and tells Deshaun Watson, no, you're going to run my scheme this year instead of Dabo Swinney's. So there's still that risk. Hopefully not, but that's a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Matt. Yeah, and I think there's a way to put it, too. And if they do stay with that same offensive scheme, you know, there's a lot of open throws created with it. Teams now have 6 games to go back off of to prepare for whenever the season goes along. You see a lot. You saw with Tennessee is a good example this year where a team makes a radical offensive change. It works one season, but then the next year defenses have an idea of how we're able to stop it. And so you have to constantly add to it. You constantly add onto it. You make it continue to work. And I mean, the one difference though is, you know, at quarterback you have Mariota, but then if you have like an all-time, no, not necessarily an all-time great quarterback, even, you know, a really great quarterback, it kind of balances that stuff out as well too. So I don't know, we'll see. They have to do a lot though offensively for, you know, things to be good again next year. And the last bit of Texans news is the fact that Mike Vrabel is interviewing for both Colts coaching job and the Titans head coaching job this week. It seems like the Colts are pretty much for sure getting Josh McDaniels, though, and that the Titans kind of came to the game too late by firing Mike Monday. So do you think Vrabel is going to be the head coach of the Tennessee Titans? And if so, how much better does the Texans get with Romeo Crennel stepping back from the game to being the defensive coordinator?
Well, that's the assumption, right? The assumption kind of was that Crennel, like, moved up so that we wouldn't lose Vrabel. That's not a bad assumption. I think it's very fair. I can't see, you know, Crennel is what, 70 years old. He's somewhere right around there. I can't imagine he was kind of ready to mentally hang him up. So I think that's a possibility that happens. I think though today after reading that Matt LaFleur was interviewing in Mesopotamia, I think that LaFleur ends up there. I think that if Vrabel gets a head coaching job at this point, and I think he interviewed for him, I could be wrong. I think the Lions is most likely destination at this point. So depending on what happens
They hire Patricia, the Patriots defensive coordinator.
They're going to hire Patricia? Okay. Yeah. I guess, yeah. So I don't know. I don't think Vrabel leaves at this point, if that's it, because the Giants are going to get Shurmur, if I remember correctly. And I can't remember who's going to Arizona. Is that Wilkes is going to Arizona?
I don't know if Arizona hasn't made up their mind yet.
Okay.
Let's see.
So Vrabel might not get a job. I think, you know, if the Colts go McDaniels, I think the Titans, if you're the Titans, I'm going, hey, I've got Marcus Mariota. I'm going to bring in Matt LaFleur. That's not even a question. So that's just my thought.
Yeah. No, the Cardinals haven't found anybody yet. And I think the LaFleur thing makes – the Vrabel to Tennessee thing didn't make a lot of sense to me at all. One, like, you have a mediocre defense. I don't know what Mike Vrabel is going to do there, aside from like a Mike Tomlin sort of figure where, you know, he calls timeouts, he game plans, he's the leader – he's like the nucleus of the team, but he's not calling the offense. You don't want him calling the defense because he was bad at it this year. And then it's not even just the injuries. I mean, the scheme was bad at times. He didn't adjust to his opponent and those sorts of things. So you don't want him calling plays at all. And then you also are hoping that he hires the right guys to be, you know, the offensive and defensive coordinator. And you're thinking that he has ties to New England or Houston. So he's going to pillage from a bad Houston staff or try to find guys he worked with before, you know, out of New England, and you don't know entirely who those guys are going to be either. So that whole thing didn't make sense. And the biggest thing with the Titans organization, too, is having Marcus Mariota succeed, you know, as best as he possibly can. So the fourth thing makes more sense. And if you don't know who he is, he's the offensive coordinator of the Los Angeles Rams this year. He didn't call any plays. Sean McVay did all that. But he started off as a assistant in Houston. He was the quarterback coach in Atlanta as well, too. And I was reading up on him a little bit earlier today, and he was also a backup quarterback for the Indoor Football League team called Omaha Beef. And their logo is hilarious because it's just like the Denver Broncos logo, except it's an O instead of the D with like a mean looking, you know, it's like if you took the University of Texas Longhorn and just made it like evil, like the Denver Broncos Bronco, that's the Omaha Beef logo. So I think a guy like that with the offensive mind is more what you want in Tennessee than a situation between Mike Evelyn, who is just good at, I guess, being tough and yelling a lot.
Right. And I forgot who was the leader right now. As I understand, kind of my takeaway from it is Mike Munchak's the leader for the Arizona job. I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, he is.
Which would be just LOL. I mean, you want to talk about a guy who the game has passed by. The game passed him by when he was coaching however many years ago. In 2011, the game was already past him. He's going to go back and so silly. So very silly.
Yeah, and I think he's kind of like a figurehead coach, like what Mike Vrabel would be, you know, like what Tomlin is, except he doesn't have the talent Tennessee there. But I think he's great as an offensive line coach. He's just not somebody you want as a head coach at all anymore. But yeah, that'd be strange though if Arizona signed him.
Yeah, no, that would be the end of that franchise. I mean, you know, for while he's there, because he's not going to improve them. He's not. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Never. I'm done. Done ranting.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. I guess the biggest thing is it does seem like Mike Vrabel is going to be here in Houston. Hopefully, he gets better at his job in a year. And I still think it's absurd that he was even a head coaching candidate to begin with. Like, let's say let's say you're a team interviewing for head coaches this offseason. You have to be cracking up at any sort of Mike Vrabel discussions, and you want somebody to hire him. A better pool of candidates to, you know, pull from. That's one position Phil, you don't have to worry about at all, and one guy out of the pool. So he looks like he's probably going to stay here. I don't know. Hopefully he gets better at his job. There's no reason he can't, but he was just really bad at it this year.
Yeah, and I don't get it. I mean, we joke often. We've done a post on it. We joke often that, you know, the NFL is really a good old boys network league. And it always has been. And it's been really bad about that at times, especially, you know, growing up in the 70s when none of those coaches happened to be black or anything. So at least that part is better. But it's very much, it's like if Brian Schottenheimer can get a job, if Ken Norton can find a job, what does it take to fail out of the league? I mean, do you have to be like Frank Bush bad to be just not have any more credibility? And so if you're looking at their bodies of work and you're saying, I got Steve Wilks here, who has done a fantastic job with this Panthers defense. Granted, he has some really good talent on that defense. Mike Vrabel had a lot of talent, has no track record of success. Are you going to really hire Vrabel over Wilks? I mean, what do you have to do to not fail up in the NFL if you just get that rep that, oh, he's a leader of men?
Yeah.
That's not really a thing. And you also have to be successful. You can be a great leader of men, but if you run them right into the gunfire and everybody's dead, well, no, they're not good leaders of men. So it's just, you know, I don't know.
Have them up and running into the gunfire, I guess. And also, I bet whenever someone asked Mike Vrabel to name a time that they overcame adversity, I'm sure he has a great answer to the question.
It's probably a Super Bowl reference, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, of course, like that time he caught that touchdown pass in the Super Bowl and how
right.
difficult it was to fight back against Carolina, you know, whatever. Well, this past weekend was too much fun, so we're going to talk about the divisional round of the NFL playoffs now, and then we'll get to some reader, you know, listener questions, whatever you want to call them, for this. So, anyways, this past weekend, what happened was that I'm now 4-4. I went 2-2 this weekend. I picked Philadelphia, England, Pittsburgh, New Orleans. You're now 3-5, and you went 2-2 this weekend after picking Atlanta, New England, Jacksonville, New Orleans. So I'm one game up on you as we enter the conference championships. And so we'll go in order talking about these games, just in the order that they occurred. So the first game of the weekend was that slot fest between the Falcons and Eagles. The Eagles outran and played better defense than Atlanta. The big topic of discussion after this game happened was the biggest play of the game. Atlanta was down 15-10. They had the ball at Philadelphia's 2-yard line. They had a 4th-and-2 call. And what happened was Matt Ryan rolled out to the right-hand side. They were trying to hit Julio on a pivot route, and he got jammed pretty good. And it seemed like Julio either slipped or fell to try to draw the holding penalty. It was kind of hard to tell. And then he got back up, and Ryan looked around, couldn't find anybody, and tried to toss the pie to him in the corner. And Jones was unable to make the catch. And also his feet looked like they were coming out of bounds as well, too. So were you okay with the play call there?
Yeah, I really was, because it seemed like to me that, yes, there was a lot of touching and feeling going on. They were expressing themselves as grown men. And I didn't see anything that really told me that it was a hold or that there was really anything wrong defensively with the play. I think I have more of a problem with the type of the play call that it was rather than what happened during the play. So I to me, it was fun, Matt.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think so at all. I didn't think either. I didn't think it was a holding penalty. I think just like Julio kind of slipped, but it seemed like in a way he was trying to draw that call and was, you know, kind of upset about afterwards. And the penalty too, I mean, like the play also – like they're lined up on the opposite hash. They're trying to hit Julio in that situation. I don't know. I mean, it's such a hard spot to call a play at where you're having that. You know, the weird thing is about it is the play they ran last weekend against the Rams, the scoring eyesight game, that was the best play they had for that situation, maybe on like, you know, second down or third down there to hit Jones, you know, coming back across the formation like that. And then they kind of, you know, wasted their best play there. But it's a hard spot to call. So I really don't. I was fine with the play call. I don't really have anything at all to, like, really, like, I don't know the Falcons' offense to say they should have done this or that because they struggle running the ball. The Eagles have a really good defensive line. Devontae Foreman was bad that game. I don't know if you're going to look for Mohamed Sanu. They targeted Julio Jones 16 times. He had 9 catches. So I'm okay with the play call as well, but it's a really difficult spot to be in.
That's a great way to put it. Sometimes it's just, you know, you really have to pull something out because when I was watching the game, I don't know if you were watching it live, but I know I was thinking they've got to go to Julio here.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. I mean, it wasn't even a question. I don't know. I guess, I mean, you're right. You really can't fault them for that aspect of it. I don't know. When I saw the play developing, it just looked like I guess I would have done something different. I would have run something like a mesh, something that creates a rub for Julio or for, I keep calling it Julio, not Julio. So I would have created a rub. I would have created something a little bit different to get them open or, you know, because everybody knew where the ball was going to go. Even I knew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and whenever as soon as the play was snapped, you knew that it wasn't going to work. Like, Philadelphia had it covered perfectly. Notice that too many guys didn't block, too. And so there was threat of the run at all. And that was, I guess, the weirdest thing about it to me was that there really wasn't that threat, but they had seven guys in blocking, only three guys going out for routes. And once Julio was covered, you look to your second and third read, they're covered because they can't open. And the only thing you do is kind of go back and toss it up. So that was the weird thing about it. I think if they ran the same sort of, you know, rollouts the right out of a shotgun formation or something, it would have worked out maybe over there. But yeah, it was weird, and it put them in a bad spot. And I'm glad the Eagles won, though. The Falcons were sick all year. They weren't that good this year. And it's good that they didn't get some easy talking to the NFC title game.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more on that. I don't have a problem with the Falcons, generally speaking, but I really wanted to see the Carson Wentz-less Eagles at least get to the championship. I mean, they at least deserve the championship game. So it's, you know, Wentz was so incredible this year. Yeah, I just think it really kind of worked out as a happy ending. Phrasing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And the Eagles had a really good offensive game plan in this one for the quarterback. They did a good job attacking Lance, cover three with a lot of quick passes out to the flat, a lot of outs, a lot of throws to the running back out there. It took a few unsuccessful shots downfield that Foles just really kind of underthrew, and they, you know, ran the ball really well. And they also run a lot of creative run plays with, you know, pulling to, you know, the weak side and having already play design cutbacks to Ajayi. Had a very solid game. And so I like what they did. And also Nick Foles threw for, you know, 260 yards or so. And the big thing is he didn't turn the ball over. He was only sacked one time. It was kind of like exactly what you want in this game, where you know that your Philadelphia's defense was going to be able to contain Atlanta's offense because their offense wasn't that good at all this year. So can you see Philadelphia's game plan to win games, like how they beat Atlanta? Could you see that working next week against the Vikings and also the week after that in the Super Bowl?
It's going to be tougher. I think the Vikings D is going to put up a much better fight than the Atlanta D. I think that's, you know, that's kind of a duh statement there, right? I don't Sendejo. I haven't seen a status update on Sendejo though, that I can remember at least. But so I think you're going to see a bunch of the same thing. I think you saw the imaginative run plays. I think there was a play where Aguilar was lined up.
Oh, I love that play.
Kind of as a fullback with an underneath draw, and you had a pulling guard. Was that Brooks that was pulling on that one? I can't remember now. I think it was.
They ran that really tight jet sweep where usually it's so much longer and elongated, and Aguilar just comes right off the tight end's hip to get that ball and take off for 19 yards to put him on the 2-yard line.
Yeah, there's just some beautiful – and I expect that. And Doug Peterson's done a great job utilizing that talent in Philadelphia too. So I think there's a lot of reason to think that, you know, without Carson Wentz, that the Eagles will be somewhat successful offensively.
Well, I think they can keep playing games like this. It's kind of like how Houston was last year, where if the game doesn't get past 17 points and they only have to score, you know, 20 points at most to win, if they're going to be in it. And, you know, the biggest thing is that they can run the ball and not turn it over. And this weekend's game has been really interesting too. But I think it can work. I don't know, maybe against New England if it could or not, but definitely next weekend I think it could. And their defense is, you know, categorized with four really good defensive linemen. You have Fletcher Cox and Brandon Graham. They play defensive tackle and passing downs, and they'll put Graham at, you know, defensive on run downs. And then you also have Derek Barnett and Chris Long who play defensive end. You have Timmy Jernigan who play defensive tackle. They also have that really big white guy from the University of Wisconsin that I'm blanking on his name. But it's characterized by a really good, you know, defensive line. And then they'll bring in, you know, safeties, defensive backs, and linebackers in, you know, depending on the offensive formation to fill up the linebacking group. And they just kind of, you know, run free from there. And in this game, they, you know, were spectacular. They were, I believe, fourth defense DVOA, seventh pass defense DVOA this year. And the biggest thing I kind of saw was the strangest thing I saw in this game from Atlanta was how bad Devonta Freeman was. He had 10 rushes for 7 yards, but then Tevin Coleman had 10 rushes for 79 yards. What was the difference between these two running backs in this game?
I don't know. I really don't know because I saw the same thing. I have to admit that I really didn't pay attention to this game like deeply until the fourth quarter. I was kind of the game was on, I was doing stuff kind of thing. For me, I just, when I was watching it, I just couldn't really see anything different. I don't know, maybe just a vision thing, but nothing really jumped out at me, Matt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nothing did for me either, but I do think this year Freeman has not looked like himself. He wasn't like he was last year. That, like, physicality and ability to break tackles isn't there. Those, like, absurd cuts he has in the outside zone game aren't there. And Freeman just looks a lot faster, and he looked like an actual running back. And, you know, I think the other thing, too, is just Coleman's better at this point of season. Freeman just isn't himself right now. If it's an injury from the concussions he's had or what's going on with him, but he's not the same player at all.
Yeah, and that might be it. It might just be that he's tentative out there.
Mm-hmm. And Ryan, this game, he averaged only 5.8 yards an attempt. I mentioned earlier that Julio Jones was targeted 16 times and 9 catches. But the most targets after that was 6 to Mohamed Sanu. The rest of the offense kind of wasn't really involved. And I think that's the biggest difference between Sarkis, the coordinator, and and Shanahan's offensive coordinator. If Shanahan was able to turn Taylor Gabriel into an incredible slot receiver, you know, Sanu was really great last year. They had like 4 different tight ends that caught passes. The running backs were in the passing game. And, you know, this game, the game plan was just kind of like run the ball and like force feed, you know, Julio Jones as much as possible, and it didn't work. What do you think was Sarkis' problem this year as offensive coordinator?
I think ultimately for me, for my money, it's the way that Shanahan was able to use his running backs out of the backfield specifically in 2016. That to me jumped out watching them play, is that they picked up easy freaking yards game mm-hmm. after game after game by just getting the running back into space, and misdirection to get the running back into space, play action to get the running back into space. But that to me ultimately is the big difference between the two offensive schemes from 2016, 2017, especially Sarkisian, because Sarkisian just simply didn't do that this year. So that's what struck out to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they did it. They just didn't do it nearly as well. I think Coleman averaged like 4 yards less of reception or 4 yards less than attempt this year. Freeman was similar, but he was a little bit worse. But they didn't have the volume that they had last year as well, and it wasn't as important
volume
in the game
yeah.
either. And afterwards, did you see Chris Long put the dog mask on? Nobody, because the Eagles were the first team to be the underdog as the one seed at home in the second round. And so afterwards, the Eagles are wearing, you know, dog masks. And so nobody believes in them. But do you believe in them, BFD?
Again, the difference is Carson Wentz. But yes, I do believe in him. I think there's at least a chance. Nick Foles, it's not like Nick Foles is Tom Savage, right? Nick Foles has literally had an all-pro type value season, right? So it's not like he is just some noob out there who does not have a track record of success. He does. He clearly does. And Doug Peterson did a great job of limiting his route tree throws, of getting guys out in the open, getting guys out in the flat, using the running game to protect them. So I think there's a chance, and I love the masks. I love the masks.
Yeah, they made me uncomfortable. I feel like I was watching The Shining. And it wasn't like a football game anymore.
Yeah.
Like, it's cool. Like, I'm glad that they did it. I'm glad they're going to do it again this weekend. I'm glad that they're allowing the fans to come into the game wearing them as long as they have them off when they check in as they go through security. But, yeah, they really just kind of really weird me out. It also kind of reminds me of there's a fighting game called Tekken. And one of the guys is a Mexican wrestler with a jaguar mask on. It's a man's body, you know, this enormous man, and he has a jaguar's head because I guess it's the mask. Whenever I was growing up playing this game, I thought it was like a jaguar man, and it always really weirded me out. And he had like a tail, too, and everything, and so it kind of revokes those same old fears, you know?
I remember that.
Yeah. If you go to your pizza, I'm sure they still have their big box Tekken arcade game you can play on. So the night game on Saturday night, I got to listen to, you know, live, you know, driving through the desert, and then went back and watched the condensed game Sunday morning. And Tennessee lost 35-14. They made the game closer than it was with kind of a garbage time touchdown. But in this game, though, they did go up 7-0 to start off. When Tennessee first scored, thanks to that Corey Davis one-handed touchdown catch, did you think that the Titans could actually pull off the upset?
No. There is no point in time did I ever think that was going to happen. I mean, the worst thing to happen this weekend really was that loss, because the Titans got smart enough and parted ways with Mike Mularkey and all of a sudden now they've got lots of offensive roster, or lots of offensive talent. They need to add a lot to the defense to make that worthwhile. But if they go out and get Matt LaFleur, that team might blow up offensively. I mean, with all those young wide receivers, Donnie Walker, a solid offensive line, that's going to be a massively different team next year with a decent offensive coordinator. So that was the worst thing that happened all weekend, because Mike Mularkey is trash. And so even when the BESFs went up, I just was kind of LOLing, saying, yeah, please get the fans hoped up, because I want to see them crushed.
Yeah, I mean, they did hold New England with two punts. They scored a 7-0. And we never at all did I think they stood any chance at all. I feel like if I was gambling live time, I would have still bet on the Patriots, you know, line. I would have, you know, put everything on them for the win that game or whatever. And that's pretty much what happened. And you have to love New England's game plan in this game. They took what Tennessee's the worst at, what they're best at, and attacked both of them. So one of the things they did was their best offensive play was running on the edges. Derrick Henry was averaging 10.32 yards a carry on left edge runs. In this game, he had two outside runs, and he picked up -2 yards on those runs. And you saw every single play, the box was stacked, his first and second down. They had one linebacker one side, and they had a safety, Linger on the other side. So Henry had nowhere to bounce the run out to. And the other thing they did was they threw a lot of quick passes to take advantage of the worst short pass defense in football. Just like Alex Smith and the Chiefs did, last week in the first half, they did the same thing as well, too. And I think I'm going to say this off the top of my head, but I know Amendola and Deion Lewis had 16 catches on 19 targets, with like 60 yards, and Brady threw three touchdowns in the short part of the field. And just completely, abused and manipulated that part of the Titans defense.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing. That's what makes the whole exotic meth mouth thing so stupid. Is you're telling defenses how to beat you, right? All that New England had to do. Let's just put everybody in the box because, that's their game plan. We're going to stop the run, make Marcus Mariota beat you because that part of the scheme is not going to be good. So it was just perfect game planning. Yes, agreed.
Well, it's also weird. Henry can't run the ball at the middle at all. He's 6'4", 230 pounds. So, I mean, I think even if you load the box up, you can still run the ball against a stacked defense. That doesn't really change that. But it's just that the tight ends weren't very good at it this year, and Henry's not a good inside running back. Murray's much better inside runs than Henry is. And it's weird because, you have this monster of a man who looks inside and then turns and wheels all the way around the line of scrimmage, and it works sometimes. But whenever you're going into a better team and you don't have Frank Zombo on the edge, you throw the lawn, this is kind of what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's so when I said stacking the box, they were setting the edge would be the best way to put it.
Yeah, and Henry also kind of reminds me of like a 5'10" 10-year-old playing YMCA basketball, but doesn't want to play in the post and wants to play point guarding the ball up every time.
When my sister played, she was 5'10". Everybody else is 5'1", but nope, she wanted to be one.
Yeah, that's funny. And the other thing also I want to mention about the Patriots in this game is they were really physical, especially on their inside runs. Mike Devlin's, cracking skulls at fullback. They're driving the first level. They're blocking, they're sticking the second level. They're really, hitting. And you have a lot of these short yard situations. And if you're going to be a tough football team like Tennessee wants to be, they're just laying down, giving up 6 yards on 3rd and 1, 2nd and 1, and those sorts of spots. And I think it's a weird dichotomy with Tennessee this year where they want to be big and physical and, strong. And then they come into a game against New England, they completely just lay down and give up, these short yardage runs and, don't stop the run like they need to and are talk a much bigger game than they actually play on the defensive side of the ball. And that was a big difference this year as well, too.
Yeah, just because they're not good defensively. I mean, if that team could seriously go into the 2018 draft and draft nothing but defense. And because they need the help that badly, just kind of across the board. I mean, you like a lot of their guys a lot more than I do, but man, I see old and slow all over the field.
Yeah, well, they have a good run defense, a mediocre pass defense. I get problems with short passes because they are slow at the linebacker position. But you have three pass rushers in Rakpo, Casey and Morgan, and it works for seeing your games across regular season. You get to play bad teams, but it doesn't work against a team like New England. And so, I mean, I think they could use another like impact defensive lineman. Everybody can use another pass rusher. But I think the biggest thing they need to do is get some speed at the inside linebacker position. You know, Woodyard had a lot of tackles, but he's too slow. Williamson had some tackles, but he's too slow too. And you really have to upgrade that ability to stop that.
Yeah, and I think getting somebody – Bayard turned out to be pretty good. I think getting some more help back there with Jackson and Logan would help them a lot too.
Yeah, you can always use more pass rushers, always use more defensive backs. But, yeah, and like obviously the biggest thing they need to do is get faster linebacker and get a slot corner to help a lot. And also the Cyprian sign was weird too because, like, he's an ace guy in the box. He's not somebody who's going to be able to cover tight ends at all for you.
No, he's an in-the-box kind of safety guy. I mean, he's not – you don't want him covering anybody.
Yeah. You want him as, like, your nickel linebacker.
Yeah, but you don't want him as your nickel linebacker because he can't – I don't know. I guess it's depending on your usage, but if you expect him to cover anybody, then you're making a bad decision.
Yeah,
know.
But instead of, like,
I can't stand Cyprian.
Yard and nickel, you know, you have Cyprian there. He's a better cover than that. He can also tackle, okay?
Yeah, that's true.
So – so are you miss Mr. Mularkey now that he's gone out of Tennessee?
I kind of missed the first part of your question.
I said, are you going to miss Mr. Mularkey now that he's gone from Tennessee?
Totally. I don't know how you don't miss guys. You know, miss the really bad coaches like Mularkey or Mike Munchak. You know, they're just – it's almost like a gimme when you play them sometimes because they're just such bad coaches. So, you know, again, if you pair up LaFleur with Mariota, that's going to hurt next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I still like the meth mouth thing. Like, I still think there's a place for it in football where if you're going to be a run-heavy offense, a big offensive line, but you still have to be able to develop a passing game and throw off of it. And Mark is able to do that. So I think, you know, it's a really good foundation you have to win football games with the offensive talent they have, with that sort of, like, you know, run-heavy style. Kind of like, I think, similar to what Carolina does. But then if you can get a guy like, you know, LaFleur or whoever – you can develop a passing game with interesting route concepts, seeing guys open. You can go between heavy and spread consistently. You can really wear teams out. And so I think Mularkey is the foundation. And I think we could see him kind of be like Jeff Fisher 2 years from now. He's saying, like, you know, that the Titans are good because of me, even though he only got them. Like, Fisher got Rams nowhere at all whatsoever. But Mularkey, I think, at least got him like halfway to where they're beating who the next head coach is.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair statement. You know, depending on what kind of impact he had, you know, on the draft and that sort of thing. But they really focus on getting offensive linemen, right? You've got a lot of foundation pieces there. The problem is the best player on your team, theoretically, is Marcus Mariota, and you're not really using his talent very well. And so, and not only that, you went out and drafted guys like Corey Davis. You've got some real speed demons at wide receiver, and you're not taking advantage of them. So you're really missing an opportunity at those two positions alone, and it's, you know, to make your team better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Sunday morning, the Jags upset the Steelers, and they led from the beginning, from the first possession on. So how proud of you, Jacksonville, for going out there and, you know, knocking out Pittsburgh and giving us a somewhat different AFC championship?
I mean, are there enough superlatives for that offensive play by the Jaguars? I mean, they just kept putting up points, and Blake Bortles, like, even went beyond game manager at times. At times during the game, it was a crazy freaking game. And Leonard Fournette is just a freak. You know, Leonard Fournette had the fastest, was the fastest running back in the NFL this year, according to, you know, their advanced stats, which is, and when the guy's like 230 pounds, he's a freak. So it's crazy to think about how they put up that many points, but I've been ragging on the Pittsburgh defense for years. I still think it's trash. It's gotten better. It's still trash. In a lot of ways. And missing Ryan Shazier hurts a lot. Vance Williams played well. But, man, that was a really fun game to watch. It was a lot more offensive than I ever dreamed it would be, and total cred to the Jacksonville offense. Matt?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was weird because, I mean, obviously the defense kind of really set the offense in that game with the Miles Jack interception, the 20-yard line, with the scoop and score that Telvin Smith had as well. And then, you know, but they still had those three, you know, scoring drives that they needed, the first one to start the game off. And also on that first scoring drive, they went for it on, you know, fourth and one. How proud are you of Jackson for actually going for a fourth and one instead of, you know, taking the points and doing what Phil Sims always says that you have to do?
No, I think that – okay, so if you're in a football game and you're fourth and – it's like fourth and one and a half on your opponent's, you know, 1.5 yard line, duh. And it's, you know, the opening drive and you've gone that far and you've got a guy like Leonard Fournette, you really, as a coach, you show a lot of confidence in your team by going for that. And I think that really sets the tone for the rest of the game. And that's one of those silly things that, you know, people like to say that, oh, well, yeah, you know, chemistry is, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I think this is a case that, man, Maroney showed that, no, guys, we're going to go out and do this. We're going to be aggressive. We're going to set the tone in this game. I think if you kick the field goal, you really set kind of the, okay, we're going to let Pittsburgh control this game. But when you go out and do that, I really think you just told your offense, we're going to do this, go kick some butt. And they did it on the same play. It was like a same run that they had scored a touchdown on against Pittsburgh earlier in the season. It was beautiful. Mm-hmm. Everything about that play was beautiful, Matt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's exactly what you need to do. And it's good to go 4th and 4th down. You saw the Eagles do it earlier that game. Or you saw the Eagles in the same situation the day before and do it as well. And they got 7. And whenever you're limited to the quarterback position – and you actually have drives that get down that, you have to maximize the points you're going to score, especially in the situation that Jackson was facing when they were trying to pull up the upset. Do you think Doug Marone's a good head coach?
I think he's better the second time around. That's for dadgum sure. I don't think he's bad. I do think he's improved. I mean, do you think Bill O'Brien would have gone 4th and 4th down there?
No,
Bill O'Brien.
He did against the Patriots the year before, you know, in the same situation.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. So that you have to take calculated risks in a league that is so risk averse. Bill O'Brien is like the most risk averse of the risk averse, and so that's why I think you have to as a head coach, you have to be aggressive, and especially when you're on the road in the playoffs, you just have to take those chances. You can't let that opportunity pass you by.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also Marone, too, his first head coaching stint was in Buffalo, and he went 8-8, and then he left Buffalo because he thought he'd get offers somewhere else and took his
somewhere else, yeah.
And left. And then nobody offered him a job, and then he caught on in Jacksonville, and then for Gus Bradley, and they kept him there. So even like his first stint, you know, he had a good year at Buffalo, and E.J. Manuel was his quarterback that year, you know. They had
right.
Call Kyle Orton in from his, you know, farm in Montana to go out there and play quarterback. Back. That was, you know, same Watkins rookie year, and that was the year Watt had the pick 6 annual and took it all the way back. Where Buffalo had that really great, you know, defensive line. So Marone at a minimum a solid head coach, you know, this year and last year's or his first stint in Buffalo too. So yeah, I mean, I think making decisions like that are really important. And I know like we try to look mainly what we say objectively whenever we talk about football, but there's a subjective thing plays a huge part, and going for it there, I do really think set the tone for the game moving forward.
Yep.
So the Jaguars game, they made a lot of really great individual defensive plays. Which one was your favorite in it?
Oh, man, that's a good question. I didn't get a chance to look at the script before. Yeah, I suck. I really like the Telvin Smith touchdown, and except for the taunting at the end of the play, because look, Jacksonville's got a great defense, granted, and even if you're up, I think it was 21-0 after that touchdown. You don't look at the Pittsburgh offense and you don't look at the Pittsburgh offense and start taunting Le'Veon Bell. You just don't do that. Just kind of stupid. But it was everything you gotta love. I mean, I'm sorry, fumble recovery. Everything about that play was like Telvin Smith. This is what Telvin Smith does really well. He gets to the ball, and he runs really fast. And I think it just kind of showcased that particular beauty that he's got as a football player. Matt?
Mm-hmm. And the cool thing about that play, too, was it was Ngakoue forcing the fumble of Roethlisberger. And his practice really wasn't that great at all. You know, Villanueva blocked him, but he helped on, you know, Roethlisberger's back as he steps in the pocket. Went for the ball and he forced it. And Ngakoue led the NFL in forced fumbles this year with 6, and he forced another one. And Smith was playing, you know, shallow coverage there. And as soon as he starts running to the quarterback and the ball just, you know, hit him perfectly, And watching it live, as soon as he got that, I was like, oh, he's gone. You know, nobody's going to touch him at all. And sure enough, that's what happened.
Yep.
So the Jags, you know, they played a great game in this one. They won 45-42. They had a nice offensive game plan, similar to what the Eagles did with Foles. They said the one difference was that Foles made absolutely zero throws in – like zero big throws in that game. And Bortles made the one really big one to Keelan Cole that made the game 35-21 after the Steelers, you know, scored to make a one-possession game in the third quarter. They're really kind of – like they needed Bortles to make one play, and he made it. And they scored immediately after that, the Fournette touchdown. But the Steelers' game plan was completely terrible and awful. I'm going to list a couple of things. One was that they were not running the ball to start the game. They kept trying to throw these quick screens out to the wide receivers, which I guess kind of – which doesn't make sense because you're going against a very fast defense. Like, I know you don't want to test Boye and Ramsey right away, and you only get the ball to your receivers in space, but you're not just going up against them. You're going up against the entire, you know, horde of fast defenders that they have. The second thing was they didn't run the ball Le'Veon Bell enough. They had a lot of success running the ball up the middle. They stopped doing that. And then they were also running like these big tosses and pitches with them, which again, you're not utilizing your offensive line. The worst part of the Jaguars' defense is their run defense, specifically up the middle. And you're giving them more time for the Jaguars' defense to come and make tackles. The fourth down and third and one attempt calls were terrible. And that kind of goes back to those weird little screens and those tosses as well. And then on defense, they struggled to get pass rush. They never blitzed. They played a lot of man coverage, which I think you should do against Jacksonville. But you have to blitz the pressure in Bortles. And you also have to spy. And they let Bortles down space way too many times and run as well. And so I really had no idea what their game plan was. It didn't make any sense. They fell behind early because of it. And I think if they played this game again, they just play it smarter, like how they played, you know, in the third quarter by feeding Bell more often and doing things like that. The game would have been a lot differently. But I'm still perplexed by just how dumb the Steelers were in that first half.
I think there's one play that really shouts that out, too. It was a fourth and one, and it was Bell running to the outside, and Jalen Ramsey absolutely set the edge on it. I think it was a fourth and one, fourth and short, and Jalen Ramsey set the edge on it and just absolutely stonewalled Bell. I mean, he beat Bell to where Bell was trying to get, and it wasn't very close. Jacksonville's weakness, right? We talked about it, is stopping the run, especially in the interior. Marcell Dareus helped, but isn't perfect. And they did not do a good job of exploiting what Jacksonville doesn't do well. It's like the anti-New England game plan. So that, yeah, I agree. That was perplexing, especially. And I might want to rethink my Telvin Smith touchdown. That Jalen Ramsey stop was just so beautiful. I mean, he just absolutely smothered Bell on that play.
Yeah, and he ran right past the tight end pulling out there to block him, and he read it and went there immediately. And the biggest thing about Ramsey is his upper body is so insanely strong for a defensive back that he's able to take on tight ends like that. And I think going back to even last week, whenever Kelvin Benjamin shoved him in the goal line, Ramsey, you know, his chest goes back, but he still – his feet don't move back at all, and he's still able to defend the play. And, you know, he just has kind of, you know, incredible – he has – probably the top 1% of upper body strength of defensive backs.
Got it. He's the speaking of freaks.
Yeah. So that's all I have to say about that game at all. It was weird. It was a lot of fun. It was how the Jaguars led the entire game but never gave up the lead against a team that's a better paper and this and that. I loved how much Jacksonville hates Pittsburgh for, you know, the trash that was talked to start the game, you know, the pregame, everything leading up to it too. Yeah, we're not going to get just that New England-Pittsburgh matchup that was kind of expected from the very beginning. The game that followed this one was the game of the century, the Minneapolis Miracle. The Vikings won 29-24. So what do you think happened to Marcus Williams in that final play?
Look, it's great. Marcus Williams deserves a lot of heat for his quote-unquote tackle on that play. And the one thing that really stuck out at me watching the first replay is afterward, you know, you don't see those subtle things, you know, during the play when it's happening itself, especially a play like that, you're kind of paying attention to the things, right? But his head was down, and he was not even looking at the guy he was trying to tackle.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, when I saw that, and I saw that replay, I was like, that is the problem with tackling right now. People are going so often for the big hit, but look how Ryan Shazier got hurt. It was the same sort of thing. He was head down, not looking at the play, head not up. That's not remotely close to fundamental tackling that they teach you in Pee Wee. So when I saw that, I was just like, yeah, yeah, that makes sense, that you totally whiff on that. But what makes less sense is that Marcus Williams was your Alamo guy on that play. Why in the heck is he the deepest guy on your team? If they complete a pass inbound, that's it. Game's over, right? Why is Marcus Williams the deepest guy on the field for that play? So that play was not Marcus Williams' fault. That play was whomever designed that play. They should have had three guys lined up at the 15-yard line and said, nobody gets past this point. And they didn't do that. You play the prevent defense one time a game, and that is the last play of the game when it should basically be a Hail Mary. And Case Keenum doesn't have the arm strength to make that Hail Mary, and that's what you did. So, wow. That, to me, that's on the DC. That's on the planning. That's less on Marcus Williams, even though that was just a really terrible freaking play, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the play more than – I think it's more on Williams than the play calling because, like, Williams is in the spot, you know. That's you can allow Stephon Diggs to make that catch. You know, he's the last guy back there because he is the safety, and they only had two, you know, safeties deep because they couldn't go all prevent because of Michael's opportunity to catch a pass, get all balance, hit the field goal for the win. So they weren't trying to stop the touchdown. They were trying to stop Minnesota from throwing the ball deep enough to and step out bounds. So they had they weren't just like able to go and just cover all the way back on it. But the biggest thing I picked up on it was Williams went for the outside leg of Diggs and missed completely because he was trying to tackle him. But I think he also was running to make a play on the ball, realized he wasn't get there in time, and then just kind of dove at the outside leg to keep him in balance. And, you know, the way Diggs came down, you know, narrow, he just missed completely on it. And like, he was making the right decision, but he just, as far as, like, which leg he took to tackle, he just missed completely, though. And then in addition to that, he took out his own guy, King Crawley. And so Crawley was unable to come back around chase Diggs too, because that would have been interesting as well if Crawley's chasing Diggs and if Diggs decides to go out of bounds, or if Crawley even potentially is able to tackle Diggs in bounds, you know, and the game ends right there because he gets caught from behind. The whole thing was really weird, though, and I haven't seen anything like it, you know, since Raheem Moore completely underplayed that ball to Jacoby Jones, you know, 4 years ago.
Right. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, it's kind of the same thing. I get it, but still, I guess what I don't get is I don't get that there is not, you know. Oh, granted, yes, you lose with the field goal, but you could have set up your guys, your team, in a way that one guy blowing a tackle doesn't blow your playoff chances. I think. And it's you can't rely on one guy to do that. You have to have several guys. Like, this is my line of demarcation for this play, and nobody is going to beat me. And I didn't see that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the other thing I've probably done, too, is maybe have blitzed Von Bell, like how they did the week before against Carolina, where they blitzed five against a five-man front and just overloaded the weak side of the pass protection. And sacked units in the game right there. I think that would have been another potential option too, and just play man to man with two, you know, safeties back deep instead of playing zone as well. It was an all time play, an all time gaffe. And I also, my favorite thing about the play was Stephon Diggs scores, takes his helmet off and just throws it. And it was the bat flip, but I think the helmet toss is just 100 times cooler.
Yeah, I don't know. That was just the one thing that comes back to me on that play, because we're eventually going to get to it anyway, is I think that play was only successful because Case Keenum's arm is so weak. Like, it just floated up there. It threw off Marcus Williams' timing. It was like kind of like how, you know, the Bismarck couldn't shoot down the slow biplane that eventually sunk in World War II. It just Marcus Williams was not made to play a ball that, you know, came down with ice on it. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. So are you going to admit that, yes, in fact, Case Keenum is the lead?
See, I knew we were going to get to it. So Case Keenum is still not good, period. the way that I look at Case Keenum right now is he's like the Bronco version of Peyton Manning. He throws with incredible anticipation, and is fortunate. And you mentioned this, that he's fortunate to have some incredible route runners, especially like Adam Thielen, Stephon Diggs. He has some great route runners, guys who really create a lot of space. That also helps him in the weak arm, because when you see him throw, it's the ball has absolutely no velocity to it. It's just none. But he's great with the anticipation. The other thing that he does, really, he's a student of, clearly he's a student of the game. So that helps with the whole thing. God, what's the point I wanted to make on it? Shoot. But anyway, but if you're going to go out and you're going to pay Case Keenum to be your franchise quarterback, you're going to regret that contract very quickly, I think. I don't see that being a consistent thing that he can do, because he just doesn't have the arm strength to do it. And you have to have some level of arm strength. You have to have certain wide receivers that are able to run certain routes for you. I just don't see this as a very repeatable thing, Matt.
Yeah, I think it's – well, we've talked about before, like, you know, arm strength's important, but I think he has enough arm strength. You know, he's shown all year that he does. He can throw to the sideline. He can throw, you know, 25 yards in the field with touch and anticipation. And, you know, it's been some things back on you too. You talked about, like, you need that one elite trait to kind of base your game around. And Keenum has it with his anticipation and his touch. Those high-reaching, you know, lofting throws that, you know, just kind of blew in the air, hit the receiver's hands perfectly. Like, that's an incredible trait. Like, he bases the entire passing game around that, and it works. I don't know necessarily if it's repeatable on a different team. Like, I think for sure that his skills match perfectly with Thielen and Diggs, you know? Like, and then with Kyle Rudolph as a red threat. Like, I think the entire offense is designed perfectly for him. I don't know if, like, if Buffalo, for example, is getting a bunch of money, I think you'd be awful there. But I think it's the perfect situation for him. And, you know, he's 29 years old. Then if they did give him, you know, $11 million deal contract, you know, moving forward, I think they'd still be in a good spot. Because I think this year is repeatable in Minnesota. Do I think he's going to lead the NFL in DVOA, be fourth in DYAR, have throw 22 touchdowns to, you know, 7 receptions? Yeah, no, probably not. But he's been elite this year as a quarterback, and I think he can still be very good in Minnesota. I just don't know necessarily if he'd be good if he just put him on any single team in the NFL.
Yeah, and the one point I wanted to make is you talked about one of his, you know, elite traits. The other elite trait that he's got, as goofy as it is he's willing to push the ball downfield. He is willing to make the ball go downfield to create plays. And so the difference between he and, like, Alex Smith this year is that when Alex Smith went back to who Alex Smith is, being super conservative, not pushing the ball, that's when the Kansas City Chiefs went downhill in the middle of the season, right? They quit stretching the defense. Everybody started stacking the box and following up Kareem Hunt. That's what happened to the Chiefs' offense this year. Injuries didn't help, especially on the defensive side of the ball, but I'm talking specifically about the offense. Case Keenum doesn't care. I mean, he's just going to keep chunking the ball downfield. And that was one trait he showed as a Texan as well, is he just, you know, the Andre Johnson game, he just was willing to keep pushing the ball down the field, just keep chunking it down the field and make stuff happen. That is really, really important in the NFL.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. And I do think he's also – I think he struggles against the pass rush, but he's mobile enough to kind of bait and get on space. And, like, I don't know, like, it's weird. Like, I never thought we'd be in a situation where – not only was Keenum 11-3 as a starter on a professional football team, but he's going to be in a conference championship game. And I thought he was never going to play another snap after, you know, last year with the Rams. And, you know, this whole thing's insane. And I do think he can be good again next year. He was really good this year. And it's going to be really interesting to see what Minnesota does with their three quarterbacks they have, with Bradford, Bridgewater, and Keenum after the season as well, too.
Well, you even heard the Vikings coach whose name I'm whiffing on, even though I can see his face. Dang it, Matt.
Mike Zimmer, the head coach.
Yes, thank you. That, you know, they were talking in the pregame, you know, about, you know, what Zimmer thought about Keenum, and he's like, he's lucky this year or something to that effect. And, you know, he wouldn't be afraid to go back to Sam Bradford if he had to. So you can even see his head coach feels about Keenum. So what they're gonna, how they're gonna sort out that situation is gonna be, it's just gonna be spectacular to watch, because I'm just really looking forward to it. Case Keenum's gonna get paid. Somebody is going to drop a lot of money. Arizona Cardinals, maybe. Somebody's going to drop a lot of money to Case Keenum. I'm not talking $11 million a year. I'm talking $15, $17 million a year, because they're going to hope that this is not an outlier.
Yeah, I don't know. I remember kind of speechless just like thinking about a team in free agency this year giving, like, it's incredible that we are at this point, you know, of this universe that we are, you know, currently living in. The whole thing's unbelievable.
What, when you talk about handing Case Keenum that much money?
Yeah, like Keenum having as good a year as he had this year, for him to be on the team this far in the playoffs as he is, you know, the whole thing's spectacular.
Yep, truly.
And I'm so happy for him. And also, shout out to all the Keenum truthers out there. You know, you were right all along. We were wrong. We were very dumb. And, you know, I love you guys for keeping the faith. But in the first half of the game, the Saints went down 17-0. What was ailing them in that first half that you saw?
Drew Brees, it looked off. Looked just very off. Even like that one interception he threw, he way underthrew that one. And that's not – Drew Brees is every once in a while struggles with the deep ball. But you're talking about one of the most accurate passers in NFL history, and he just does not often make mistakes like that. I really think it was Drew Brees, and which I hate to say because he's one of my favorites. I love watching him play. He's a local boy. He grew up just like literally like 10 minutes from here. So it was him, I think.
Yeah, well, I think it was that because, the Saints just struggle in their third downs in that game too. And he was weirdly inaccurate also. You know, Brees is the most accurate player in the history of football, and he just wasn't as accurate as he usually is. And the problems that they have are they were trying to run more power runs, and they were unsuccessful at that. Second half, they ran more outside zone plays, and you were much better running the ball. And also, defensively, they didn't force any negative plays at all. Every play is successful. Minnesota's consistently picking up 5 yards on first down, you know, 4 yards on second down. It can be really easy, you know, third and shorts too. And, you know, the Saints defense in the red zone really kind of saved them from making that game a blowout and having that lead being, you know, a lot more insurmountable than it was. So I think the biggest thing that changed was, you know, third downs, their receivers were actually able to beat man coverage, the change in the run scheme. And then also defensively, they were able to follow up for pressure on Keenum and create some negative plays instead of just allowing Minnesota being perfect situation over and over again.
Yeah, how much did you enjoy the Keenum, the sack where Case is running backwards? How much did you enjoy? I enjoyed that play immensely. That's kind of my favorite thing about Case's time as a Texan, that running backward sack.
Yeah, I loved it. And I wrote that article too for that Read Optional site where I looked at one standard deviation from the mean of all sacks, and it was 7 yards or more. Used the baseline, saw who had the highest percentage of them, and it was Case Keenum. So I called it the Keenum. So every sack rate, 7 years was that. And I do need to update that entire spreadsheet this summer and bring that back. But yeah, and also the interception he threw too on the sideline, that was Cameron Jordan chasing on off the back foot, running backwards,
yep.
and throw the sideline. And that's all. And you kind of answer him that running backwards stuff, but he is better at it. So is this the best football game you've ever seen?
It's way up there. I mean, there are a few that have just been spectacular. The Patriots-Seahawks Super Bowl game. This one's way up there. It was just so much fun with the crazy surprise ending. And you know, who didn't think the Saints were going to win that game at the end of it? And all of a sudden, Marcus Williams blows a tackle and Stephon Diggs is just running down with nothing but green in front of him for what, like 40 yards or something crazy, right? That was just nuts. That was all sorts of nuts.
Yeah, it was like a baseball playoff game that ends with a walk-off home run. And I don't remember ever seeing it before in a playoff game. And I think they said that it hasn't happened. I don't know. They said it's never happened in a playoff game or it's never happened in a divisional round, where a team won with a walk-off touchdown like that. But, yeah, it was an all-time classic, and it was cool that the Vikings finally had something good happen to them instead of this happening the other way around.
Right.
Yeah, and we could spend, you know, I guess our entire lifetime before talking about this game. So moving forward, we have two games this weekend. We'll make our picks real fast and then answer the two beer questions we have. And one of them is kind of related to this first game. The first game, or the second game, I should say, the first game is the Jaguars at Patriots at 2:05 p.m. The Patriots are 9-point favorites. So who do you have in this game? And you know, talk a little bit about what you're looking forward to, what you're looking forward to in it. What do you think is going to happen?
So anybody who's listening up, Huggy and I were actually talking about this game. And this, how much does this game resemble the 2016 Texans Patriots game?
Yeah, I was thinking similar too about it.
Yeah, it's just, it seems like it's almost like a replay of that game. That it's just a really outstanding defense against Tom Brady. And if there's one thing that the Jaguars can do, it's create that interior pressure. They're better outside, obviously. But I think if you sort of move Calais Campbell around in this game and let him kind of do a little bit of a freelancing thing, and move, especially moving him to the inside over center and guard, and really start banging on those A-gaps, I think you could kind of create the same problem for Brady. And Brady doesn't mind as much that outside pressure, but, man, he gets rattled by inside pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's how they win this game. They bring it in the middle. They don't let Brady step up. They don't – Ngakoue is going to come off the edge. Fowler's going to come off the edge. You've got to bring that interior pressure, I think, to beat Brady. I think if they do that, the Jaguars can actually win this game. Look, Jaguars can win this game. I'm going to just say it flat out. They can. There's no reason they can't. New England's defense is not good. And I could definitely see Leonard Fournette gashing people. New England had the 30th worst rushing defense by DVOA. Look, mm-hmm. The Jaguars can gash them. They can win this game 17-13. It would not shock me a bit, Matt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it has to be kind of like the Denver, you know, kind of way. And Houston, you know, again, like it still is sick, you know, sickening. Just the thought that the Texans could be the Patriots in the playoffs last year, but they had your name redacted at quarterback, and that prevented that from happening. And so in this game, you have to run the ball. You have to create interior pressure, like you're saying. You have to put Malik Jackson and Calais Campbell over the guards, over the center. You can really attack their left guard, Joe Thuney. He's not a good pass protector, and that's a big opportunity there for them to attack. You have the horses to cover. The one place I think the Jaguars can be in the passing game is Gronkowski, and also deep passes to the middle of the field. Both Tayshaun Gibson and Barry Church have given up big passes downfield. The Martavis Bryant pass was an example of that. The Seahawks game was an example of that as well. But if the Jaguars are winning, it's going to be all about pass rush, getting a lead early, not turn the ball over. Because if New England gets up early, they can run the ball against Jackson. Deion Lewis has been great, and you can run the ball up the middle against the Jaguars too. So I think the Patriots are going to win. I think they're going to win by 10 points, but it's not going to be some huge blowout at all. And I think the Jaguars will play more than tough in this one.
Well, I'm going to just be really contrarian, and I'm going to say Jacksonville 24, New England 17.
So you're going
and I think I'm going all in on the Jags. This is probably not rational at all. But, two of my favorite defensive ends in the league are Calais Campbell and Malik Jackson. So I'm just going to go with those two guys. Owning the game, owning the middle, really rattling Tom Brady. So there's my go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I knew England in 24-14. And also the weird thing about that Jaguars game, too, against the Steelers is that they had issues. They didn't get any pass rush from Roethlisberger at all. But I think that was more the fact that the Steelers have three Pro Bowlers on there. They have two all pro players in DeCastro and Pouncey as well. And I think they had a big reason why they struggled to get pass rush in that game.
Yeah, and yet a sack created a turnover that created a touchdown. So
yeah, and that wasn't a great play by Ngakoue as far as a pass rush.
Mm-hmm.
That was Roethlisberger stepping up. So.
And holding onto the ball too long like he likes to do.
Yeah. So next one we have – so I guess the viewer question we have in here is from Freedom Ride. That Case Keenum, Alex Smith, and Kirk Cousins are available. Jacksonville has to sign one of them. Can they seriously ride with Bortles next season?
So I started looking at Bortles over the weekend. I think that the team has an option for him for 2018, if I'm reading that correctly,
they
that
do.
He does not have guarantee. Yeah, so it's not guaranteed money, right? It's an option. So
yeah, if they give them the option, it's guaranteed then. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. So I don't know. They've got – Jacksonville signed so many guys over the recent years. They are actually starting to bump up against the cap quite a bit. So depending upon the increase that happens during the offseason, it's already been announced. So it's already baked into the numbers. Look, if I'm Jacksonville, I am all in on Kirk Cousins. Like, you have to look at what Blake Bortles has done. You have to look at what his body of work says, and you have to see that he is not an adequate quarterback for a championship team. He's just not. He's a game manager at best. If I see Kirk Cousins out there and I'm Jacksonville, that's the last guy I need. I'm going to go out and get him. You can cut a guy like Alan Hearns to save cap space. I would be willing to do that. Got to go get that quarterback in there. So that's what I would be thinking if I'm Jacksonville. I don't know if that's what they're going to do, and it's going to put them quickly into cap hell. But, man, once again, flags fly forever. You got to go out. You got to get the quarterback that you can think can lead this team for the next 3 to 5 years. While you've still got Calais Campbell, Malik Jackson, A.J. Bouye, Jalen Ramsey is going to be under team control for a while, Talvin Smith, Miles Jack. Man, put a quarterback in there, and you might have a run of a couple Super Bowls, Matt.
Mm-hmm. And I guess Alex Smith also fits in there, too. And the weird thing with Bortles is that they extend by him like $12 million next year. If they give him that fifth-year option, they could also give him like a three-year contract, maybe pay him like $7 million a year, and that would stay like Alex Bortles and be able to invest in other positions, too, where you're still kind of keeping him on a rookie contract. And I don't know what they're going to do. I think it'd be kind of sad if Bortles isn't the quarterback for the Jags because they lose so much as far as the team does. And, like, he fits in, like, really perfectly as kind of like that kind of culture that, I don't know, they have. And, like, he's become such a weird, like, a strange rogue figure for the Jaguars as well, too.
Yeah, because he's – Jacksonville is, like, a pitiable team in a lot of ways. And Blake Bortles is kind of like the Will Ferrell of quarterbacks, right? And so it's like they're the sad but happy losers because, look, we're going to lose and look at all the tarps and we're going to wear uniforms that look like somebody peed on us. So there's kind of that lovable loser but in a pathetic way, and I think that describes Blake Bortles pretty well. So it would be sad to lose Bortles, but, yeah, if I go get Kirk Cousins, I wouldn't touch Case Keenum. Alex Smith has already proven he's not a guy who can get you far in the playoffs. Go get Kirk Cousins. I think you win big.
Yeah, I don't know if they'd be able to afford him, but I have to look into that even more, too, because I think Cousins is going to want, like, $22 million a year, and Jacksonville kind of blew all their cap space the past two seasons. I have to look more into that, though.
Bortles' cap hit – I was just going to say, Bortles' cap hit next year, if they exercise the options, $20 million.
20?
Yeah.
Huh, I guess that Clowney was going to be 12 if they gave him the fifth-year option, which they're going to do. Maybe it's more because he's the third pick and he's a quarterback, maybe.
And he's a quarterback, so he fits into that quarterback slot.
Gotcha. Okay. Huh. Well, that's an entirely different thing then. The afternoon game is going to be the Eagles. The Eagles are home dogs again as a 3-point underdog. So, this question is from True Text fan. Case Keenum could actually be a starting quarterback in the Super Bowl. Is this reality?
Yes. Yeah, that is reality. And it's in that crazy reality, Case Keenum starting after being 11-3 and starting a Super Bowl game, it could happen.
So who do you like in this one?
I don't know. It's hard picking against the Eagles and that defense, but you can say the same thing against the Vikings. Case Keenum is better than Nick Foles. I think the overall, I would take the Phillies or take Philly's offense and their talent over the Vikings. Man, I finally have to make a pick on this one, don't I? I think I'm going to take the Eagles in a low-scoring game. I'm going to take them by one. I'll take them
24-23. I have the Vikings winning 20-13. I think the Vikings defense is slightly better. I think their rushing attacks are comparable, and the Phillies is slightly better. And I just think the Vikings passing game is better than the Eagles. And I think Case Keenum is going to make more plays than Nick Foles can to win this game. And, Case Keenum is going to be a starting Super Bowl quarterback, and he's going to win a Super Bowl, too. I think the Vikings are going to be the team with the Super Bowl this year moving forward.
Wow. Case Keenum love.
Yeah. Well, it's just also the Vikings, too, have such a good roster as well. I think Case Keenum's going to be a Super Bowl champion. What a world. And even if it doesn't
starting
happen.
Quarterback.
And just like the fact that that came out of my mouth. You know, if you told me in 2013 this was going to be a thing, I don't know. Being alive is such a
thing. You would have asked for the sweet taste of death. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird the fact that Donald Trump's our president, or Case Keenum's can be could possibly be a Super Bowl winning quarterback. Very very strange worlds that we're in. You know, nothing makes any sense anymore. And the last question we have here is from Freedom Ride. He said, "Do the Texans bring in Yates and Savage to camp this summer, or do they look for a better veteran backup quarterback and rookie be quarterbacks 2 and 3? Alternate quarterback question is, Watson goes on IR again. Do we even care what happens in this cruel, ugly world anymore?"
All right. So I do think that we will probably bring back Yates and Savage because that's what we do. I mean, Yates has had 3 fours on this team already. There's no reason to think he won't have a fourth. Savage knows the system. He's been in it 4 years. Clearly, he's the better starting quarterback than Deshaun Watson. So he'll be back. I just really think both these guys will be back because this goes back to our – well, and I was under Rick Smith, but I think a lot of it's going to fall under Bill O'Brien as well, is being risk-averse. These guys know the playbook. They know how to get to the stadium. Let's just bring them in. If it were me, I would definitely go out. Look, Tyrod Taylor is somehow falling out of favor everywhere he goes. I go out and try to get him as my backup. I go get a guy with a similar skill set that has Deshaun Watson as my backup rather than Tom Savage or T.J. Yates, and that way my playbook kind of stays the same.
Yeah.
And my offensive line has better expectations. So that's what I would do. I think that having either of those guys as a backup to Watson is silly, but I think they're both going to be back, Matt.
I think both being gone, I don't know if they're going to get a quarterback like Ty God Taylor to play there. But I don't think there's any way you can bring – Savage is a free agent. You know, Yates is a free agent. It couldn't be either of them coming back unless it's, like week 7 and Watson's hurt and the backup quarterbacks hurt. You just have to bring somebody in.
I see this as just punishment for being alive, that we let these guys come back.
Yeah, I was watching Ken Burns of Vietnam War, and one of the things a Vietnam officer told an American troop after he was a POW said, dying will be easy, but living is what's very hard. And so I think if Watson got injured that'd be the easiest way to put it, or the best way to put it.
Yeah, because I just don't have any faith in Bill O'Brien's offense unless Deshaun Watson's running it, and it's going to be the same crap, especially if we go get a quarterback. If Tom Savage is back, again, I easily see this as a scenario. If Tom Savage is back, we're going to go back to the same offense you saw in 2015, 2016, 2017, it's going to be the same dadgum offense, and it's going to make you want to just chug all the bleach.
Yeah, I don't want to think about this, though. Let's be happy. It's January. We have Conference Championship Week. But thanks for the questions, True Text fan, and Framerod, thanks for listening live. By listening live, you listen to record. Thanks, well, too. Enjoy your weekend watching some great football, and if you have a chance, review us on iTunes, tell your friends about the podcast. We'll be back on live again next Tuesday at 7 p.m. Central, talk about the conference championship games and whatever Texas news come up. But thanks for being on tonight, BFD. And my name is Matt West, and thank you for listening to Bell Rim Radio.
Woo!
I thought it was pretty good.